Okay, good morning. Welcome to the last lecture. And today I would like to do two things. So first of all, I would like to do two advanced applications of what we have seen so far. So applications of Fourier transform and Green's function. And then in the remaining time, I would like to tell you what actually I am interested in my research so that you know if you are interested in similar problems that we can talk. So for the advanced applications, and I'll be using the language of special relativity. So if you are, you know, so it'll be advanced stuff. So if you don't understand everything, don't worry. You will see it again during the course, advanced applications. And the first application will be propagator. So that's an application to quantum field theory, if you want. So I heard that actually Eggy made fun of me that I did quantum mechanics in, let's say, 20 minutes, one of the lectures. So now I'll do it in 2 minutes, right? Okay, so if you have quantum mechanics, then everything there is to know about it is hidden in this path integral. And the path integral is simply an integral over some obscure measure, which nobody knows how to define properly. And then there is a weight. And what stands here is the classical action. So 0 to t, L, q, q dot, and dt. So if you have classical mechanics, this will be the classical action which you describe your system. So for example, for particle, you write L equals to 1/2 q dot square minus V of q. And that's it. So the classical action provides some kind of weight to this path integral measure. And the way how you calculate it, so this is path integral measure, and you will see this in quantum mechanics course, you know, starting September, but I'm sure some of you have seen already. But one interesting thing is that, well, there's a nice classical limit, so if h bar goes to zero, then you have classical physics, so then there's an infinity here. And what contributes actually, so now this guy may oscillate, and you the classical physics will occur at the point where actually the oscillation disappears. So when the gradient of that is when the action is stationary, then you have major contribution, and that explains you that if I travel in classical physics from one point to another point, I travel in one path, which is the stationary part of this action. But in quantum world, you can go around that trajectory and stuff like that. Okay, so that's quantum mechanics in 2 minutes. Now let's do something more complicated. Let's do quantum field theory. And that's exactly the same thing. So now, let me do this, delete this so I have more space. You define not path integral, but functional integral, because it's a function of functions. Then it's functional. So you define z to be an integral. So now you have fields. So instead of particle trajectories, instead of q, I have field phi. Okay. So there is a path. There is an integral measure d phi. And again, what you put here and you weight it. So since now on, I will set h bar equal to 1. So h bar equals to 1. So now there will be classical action for the field. And the simplest classical action is actually Klein-Gordon field, if you heard about it. It's a relativistic scalar field. Okay, so there will be classical action for that. So now I'm in space-time. So I don't integrate over time only, but I integrate over space and time together. So d4 of x. And then the action is 1 minus 1/2 d phi square minus m square phi square. I'll use this 1/2. That's what I expected. Minus some potential And plus, you may have some external source and firefx. Okay, so many things. So first of all, this is the mass of the scale field. That's a kinetic term, so it's something like q dot square. But there's also a gradient of phi. So d here, it's a derivative in space-time. So it's dt and the thing. So, and the normal gradient thing here. So actually, this term contains time derivative of phi, which precisely corresponds to q dot square. So that's a kinetic term. But also, it contains spatial derivative of phi. And there are good arguments to actually that should be something like potential energy already, because it's not time derivative, it's spatial derivative. So this term contains kinetic plus potential. And this is a potential energy if you have m. And then you can add an arbitrary higher order terms in phi. And that's a potential here, and then it's an external source. So these two things will be here if you have free field. Basically, like free particle, you don't have that b. And this is a potential, and then is an external source. So I can have a sink which actually consumes my particles, or I can inject the particles into the system, and so they'll be described by this function J. Yeah.
Is there any choice of times there?
So all depends. Very good. So all depends on which signature you are using. So again, I'm in Minkowski space now. So I'm using. So my favorite signature is minus plus 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 signature. So if you use the other, then you will have plus here. So yeah, it's a matter of convention what signature you use. Okay, so that's it. And this interactions. And the statement is all there is to know about quantum field theory is precisely this integral. So from this integral, once you can calculate this integral, then you know everything. And of course, the catch is that you can never calculate this integral. You can calculate it if the field is free, but once you have a potential there, you can only calculate it perturbatively. So you basically expand in perturbations in V, and then you can calculate order by order in perturbation theory this integral, but there's no way how to calculate it completely. Okay, so now the whole thing in that bracket is also denoted. So here you have Lagrangian. So now in the bracket, it's also something like Lagrangian, but people write kel L instead of big L. And that's basically Lagrangian density. Lagrangian density. And maybe you've seen this in Dennis's course. You've seen that. So if you want Lagrangian, you simply integrate your Lagrangian density over the space. And then you see that it precisely has the same form. So now what is left in that integral? So I separate d4x into dt and d3x. And then I will have dt of the Lagrangian. And Lagrangian is d3x of L. OK. So that's it. And we are done with quantum field theory. So now one thing which I remind you again, you know that from Dennis's course, that classical equations of motion are obtained. So you know that if you have classical mechanics, you have something like Euler Lagrange equations, which give your trajectories for the particles. So here, the same story. You have now Euler Lagrange equations, but for fields. And they look like d mu. So d mu is d, which I wrote there. So mu goes from 0 to 3. 0 is dt. 1, 2, 3 is nabla. So d mu dl over d mu phi minus dl over d phi equals to 0. So that's your Euler-Lagrange equation. And that tells you everything about classical field. Yeah, 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 sorry. Yeah, I treat d mu phi as variable with respect to which I actually differentiate. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Okay. So now for free field, so which means I just take the first two terms in that Lagrangian density. So what do I get? So maybe I shouldn't do it. Okay, so Lagrangian is minus 1/2 d mu phi d mu phi, that's d phi square minus 1/2 m square phi square. So let's do it. So dl over d mu phi, I treat this guy as the thing which I differentiate with respect to this. So if I do it, I pick up that term, right? So I just kill that term by differentiation. But I have this term twice there. Basically, it's once here and second time is here. So it's twice that thing. So it's minus, so it's d mu of minus d mu of phi, right? I pick up it twice. And then I'm done with the first term. And then the second term, I differentiate with respect to phi. Phi is here. So it's minus, it's plus m square phi equals to 0. And the same thing which we introduced yesterday was this box operator, which now I write like d mu d mu, and it is minus d square over dt square plus blah blah square. It's the same thing. So now I write it like minus, is the minus right? Yeah. So my equation of motion, d square minus m square acting on phi equals to 0. And this is Klein-Gordon equation. And you can think about it like a relativistic generalization of the Schrödinger equation if you want. But it's a classical field equation. So if you have a field, then this is an equation that satisfies in the simplest case. Who has seen this? Everybody, very good, very good. Very good. So I'm doing trivial things. Very good. Okay. So now you want to calculate this function z, this functional z. So want z. I told you that in general you cannot calculate it, unfortunately. Otherwise you would solve quantum field theory, which still hasn't been done. But you can do it for free. So want z for free field. Possibly with source. Okay. And one trick how to do that is integrate by parts, that integral which you have over there. So integrate by parts. Okay, so we have z. So we are in free field, so that v is not there. So we have z equals to an integral d phi. Now there is an exponential I integral d4 of x. Okay. So now I want to shift the derivative. So I have d phi and d phi, precisely what I was writing here, d mu phi, d mu phi. So now I want to move one of the derivatives to the other field, right? So I pick up minus sign, so I'll have now plus. So I'll have plus 1/2. Then the term which I pushed is a phi, and then I have d square. And then the other term I'll keep. So it's minus m square and phi. Okay, so I just moved derivative from one phi to the other. So I have phi standing on its own, and then I have two derivatives acting on the other phi. Okay, and then plus j and phi. Okay, and then I have boundary term, but I'm free field theory, nothing happens at infinity, blah, blah, blah. So there's no boundary term. So now you notice actually that this is a field equation, which we derived in classical things. So just integrating by parts, you get a field equation here. Okay, so let's denote this by I, and our task will be to calculate this. Questions so far? Everybody happy? Everybody happy. Okay, so now remind another thing from Dennis's course. And it's again about the Gaussian integration. So I showed you how to integrate in one variable. So now we need more variables. So if you have integral from minus infinity to infinity, dq1, dqn, and so q is actually form a vector, n-dimensional vector. So q1, q2, q3, and qn. And then I have a problem. So I form this vector. There is a matrix, A. And there is this vector again. So I get a scale number, right? So if I multiply matrix by a vector, I get a vector. Scale product with a vector gives me a scale number. This is just a matrix thing, okay? Plus I j times q. So now I treat j to be also a vector. So here, these things are vectors. And this thing is a matrix. And if you've seen it, I am sure, in Dennis's course. So just remind you that. So now you can calculate this. You can basically transform everything into one-dimensional Gaussian integrals. And in the end, what you find out is 2 pi I. And there is determinant of this matrix A to power 1/2 exponential minus I over 2 j times A minus 1 times j. Okay, so funny thing, the most trouble thing is actually to get this prefactor here, right? So when you are trying to calculate this integral, this is the pain to get this determinant and blah, blah, blah. So paradoxically, in quantum field theory, you don't care about this prefactor at all. You will just throw it away and you say, well, you absorb it into integral measure and so on. You are not interested in that. So what is actually interesting for QFT is this part here. And that's trivial to get from this integration. So now what is, so this is a vector again, and this is the inverse matrix, matrix to matrix A. Okay. So why I'm doing this? So if you look at this expression, then I'm claiming this expression is of the same kind as that expression over there. Okay, we have j, that's perfect. So now j is a function of x. It's a continuous function of variable x. So now let's assume that our space is not continuous, but it's discrete. Then I have one j for x1, and I have j for x2, j for x3, and so on. So actually, if our space were discrete, then we would have, you know, infinite number, but discrete j. So it j would be an infinite dimensional vector, right? So now you just make x continuous, and the vector simply becomes just a little bit bigger, right? So for each x, I have one value of j. So you can think about j as a infinite dimensional vector for each x. You have value of j. So the same for phi. So what stands there for each x actually is j times phi, which is exactly this j times q, but now it's an infinite dimensional thing. But otherwise, it's exactly the same thing. Okay, very good. So now we have a vector here, phi, another vector field, phi, here. So the last step is to say this guy is a matrix. Right? So this, I'll treat this guy as a matrix A. Okay, so let me be a little bit more precise. So what I have there, I'm trying to argue that what I have there is basically phi times matrix A times phi. Right? Let me use Dirac notation. So what I have there is phi scalar product matrix phi. Right? So that's what I'm claiming is there. Okay. So now use this decomposition of unity in the X space, as we have done two lectures ago. So I'll decompose in X and I'll decompose in Z. So two, yes?
Field is real.
Field is real, yeah. Okay, so I'll put phi X X A. So that's one unity here. And then Z, Z, and phi. Okay, I haven't done anything. I just put one and one there, right? Okay, so now what is this guy? This you would call to be a matrix element at positions X and Z, right? This you would normally call phi of Z. And this you would normally call phi of X, possibly star, if it were not real. Very good. So now I want this to be what I'm writing on the on that side. So I want this to be an integral d4 of X phi d square minus m square phi. This is what I want it to be. So I want this. So now by inspection, yes? No, nothing. So now by inspection, I claim that this will be true if this matrix X and Z will be delta function X minus Z, D square, let's say in X, doesn't matter, minus M square. Okay, so let's see if it is true. So this sum is indeed an integral, right? So it's just a sum. So this is an integral over X. This is an integral over Z, right? So let's write it. So what I really have there is d4 of x, d4 of z. Then I have phi of x. And then this is my ansatz, which I'm saying it is delta x minus z, d square minus m square of x and phi of z. Okay. So now I can use the delta function, which simply kills one of my integrals. And I get that this is equal to d4 of x, phi of x, d square minus m square, phi of x. Precisely what I want. Right? OK, very good. So we have concluded it is A, x of n z equals to delta x minus z, d square minus m square. So basically, what you have done is that you said that differential operator may be treated as a matrix. Right? So I have a matrix. Okay. Trivial, right? Trivial. Okay. So we have that. So now we want to use that formula to calculate Z. So all we need, I told you that we don't need that stupid prefactor 1 over determinant of A and blah, blah, blah. We don't need that. What we need is this exponential, so j a minus 1. So you need to find a minus 1. So you need to find an inverse of this differential operator, and then you solve your problem. Okay. So neat. Inverse to A. So that's, well, it's inverse. It's so important that it has its own letter. And it's denoted by D, usually. So let's put D. And what I mean by that is simply A to minus 1. Yes?
So in the prefactor, there's a 2 pi to the N. Is it problematic when you take N to infinity?
Well, there are so many infinities, you don't really bother about that. Yeah. Well, you know, this will be explained once more in QFT course. So when it actually comes to this, you can ask the QFT guy, and let's see what he says. Okay. Okay, but ask that question again. Okay, so we denote this inverse, which you want to calculate by D. So now, what does it mean? Let's, again, calculate a matrix element. And let's calculate a matrix element of 1. So A times A minus 1 is 1. Right? That's the definition of the inverse. So this must be 1. So this must be equal to X and Y. And you know that these are normalized, so this is delta X minus Y. Let's remember that it's enforced in space-time, so it's a four-dimensional delta function, if you want. Okay? So that's good. So let's do the same trick. Let's now insert Z in between these two things. So let's put it X, A, Z, D, Y. I haven't done anything. And let's use what we have calculated this guy is. Okay. So this we will simply say that this is D of Z and Y. Right? It's a matrix element evaluated at Z and Y. And this guy, we know what it is. It's this delta X minus Z, D square minus M square. So well, this is actually equal to So this, okay, well, let me write it. So D4 of Z, and then we have delta X minus Z, D square, let's say in X, minus M square, and then D, Z, and Y. What have I done? X, Z, Y, that's fine, okay. And now you can integrate it, right? You can kill the integral by the delta function. And what you have is that this equals to d square in x minus m square. So let's forget about x. D, and instead of z, I write x. So x and y. Okay. Hooray. So look at what we have actually discovered. So we have discovered that d square minus m square on d, x, and y equals to delta 4 x minus y. Have you ever seen an equation like that? So very good. So you have seen. So there's some differential operator acting on something which has two variables and equals the delta function. It's precisely the definition of the Green's function, right? So this guy, so what I'm saying is that, okay, so this is a Green's function. It's a Green's function for my classical field equation, right? So this is my classical differential operator describing classical field. And so this is a Green's function for Klein-Gordon equation. Okay. But in quantum field theory, it has a more fancy name, and it's called propagator. So there are Green's functions in quantum field theory. They play a very important role. And so once you know it, so let's assume that you can actually calculate this D, then you know that, so once known, then you write that Z, and now I'll be cheating exactly doing with that prefactor something. So I will say Z at non-trivial J will be Z at trivial J. So you see that the prefactor doesn't depend on J, right? So I absorb everything into this Z zero. I absorb that prefactor 1 over the determinant of A. I absorb other things and so on. So it's Z at zero. And then it's exponential minus I half. And then it'll be two integrals d4 of x, d4 of y, j of x, d, x, and y, j of y. And so we solved our problem. So once we know d, then we are using that formula. So it's j, a minus 1 is d, and j at different points of scale product. So this will be the solution for our quantum field theory problem. Okay? Yes?
Just for curiosity, I know that you are taking that factor of the determinant into set 0, but I mean, you're dealing with differential operators. So how would you define that determinant of a differential operator?
There are ways to do it, yeah.
Okay.
Read Green, Schwarz, and Witten book on string theory. I think the first appendix is nicely devoted to how to copy.
Right.
Maybe in Polchinski it is as well.
Okay, and the second one, if I take a Lagrangian for other type of field, is there any way to see from the first time that the differential operator is invertible? I mean, that your Green function will exist?
That's a good question. There are certainly cases when this will not be true, right? When you cannot invert. So for example, if you have gauge theories, if you have electromagnetism, so you cannot in general invert these things. So you have to do some gauge fixing first. So basically, if you describe electromagnetism, you know that there's a gauge freedom. You have this function lambda, which you can choose whatever it is, so that you change phi and a, right? So if you don't fix phi and a by choosing this lambda, then actually the differential operator cannot be inverted. You can show that. But once you fix that, and there is a procedure called Fadeev-Popov procedure, how to fix these things, then you can invert it. So yeah, you have to be more careful. But in the case of scale field, it's simple and it is invertible, I think in most of the cases. Yeah. Okay. So once we know D, we have completely solved our problem for free field. Unfortunately, not only for free field, but at least with the source. Okay. So let me put a few remarks. So, oh no, I just deleted it? No. Very good, I still have it. So, if you look at this integral has an I in the exponential, right? So, which means that the integral is actually the integrand is oscillatory, right? It's something like integrating sine and cosine. And you know that if you integrate sine and cosine, it's not very good. You need something so that actually at infinity your function actually goes to zero so that you can integrate it. Okay, so remark one. So let me remark that for I to converge, a simple thing is to add some exponentially decreasing part to that. So I am saying the simplest way how to do that is we set, instead of m squared, instead of mass, you add to mass a tiny imaginary part. So you go m square minus I epsilon. Epsilon is real positive number. So the shortest mathematical joke is that small is that epsilon is small negative number. Okay, so I don't know if it's funny, but well, epsilon is always positive bigger than zero, right? Okay, so once you do that, then you have I, and then so you have minus m square in the integral. So you have okay, so you have I times minus m square in the integral now becomes minus I m square. Now I have minus minus, and I have I. That's probably minus epsilon or something like that. So then you have exponential of minus epsilon. So that's and then you integrate this over space, which is infinite. So you have something infinitely decreasing. So that's actually, if you do this, then your integral will converge. So this is a Feynman's prescription. So Feynman's prescription. Prescription. One of the teachers in my university tried to show the whole of his life that this integral doesn't exist. And in the end, at the end of his life, he said, well, actually, it does exist. Okay, so that's sad. Okay, so anyway, that's the remark. So now we have that equation for D, so let's solve it, right? So let's solve for D. And the best thing is, of course, Fourier transform, right? Solve for D. Using Fourier transform. So I do the same trick as I did with the wave operator. I just use inverse Fourier transform for my D. It will again happen that D actually depends on x minus y. So I will just, instead of x minus y, I'll write just x. Okay. So d of x, when you Fourier transform that, it gives you 1 over 2 pi to the 4, you're in 4 dimensions, d4 and k. Now, dk, this is 4-dimensional k. And then my operator, d square, okay, so I'm solving that equation there. So d square minus m square plus I epsilon using that prescription, e to I k times x. So that's operator, so that's this is left-hand side, but now with D in the Fourier transform space. And that equals to the delta function. And our beautiful familiar formula is just D4 of k e to I k times x. Right? So that's Fourier transform of the delta function. So that's our equation. So now it's very simple to solve it. So all I differentiate is exponential, bringing out a to I to k down. So I gives me minus. So this guy here will be minus k square minus m square plus I epsilon on e to I k times x. Now you compare what you have on the left-hand side with what you have on the right-hand side, and you see from here that dk equals to what?
1 over k square.
Uh-huh. Very good. So it's minus k square minus m square plus I epsilon. And that's a propagator. In k space, in the momentum space. So now you have to go back if you want to know how the propagator looks in x space. But actually, for all the applications in quantum field theory, it will be sufficient to actually know that the propagator, how it looks like in the k space. So this will be, in order to do any calculations in QED or whatever, or quantum field theory, this will be basically enough to know. So now you have all the tools to do calculations in quantum field theory. Yes?
That I epsilon prescription is changing you the poles of your propagator, right?
Exactly.
Shifting, but doesn't that have consequences on the results?
Yeah, so it has. But you know, you have to argue on physical grounds. You have to argue that you argue that the physics has to make sense, right? In order the physics makes sense, the mass must make sense. So that integral must exist. If the integral doesn't exist, the physics probably doesn't make sense. So you first make sure that the integral exists, and that gives you this prescription here, and then you have to calculate this prescription.
But with that prescription, your integral exists even if you don't know what your integration measure is.
Okay.
More read Grimm and Jaffe.
What was that?
If you really want to know what the integration measure is.
Well, the integration measure is something bad. Okay, let's assume that it is good. Again, ask QFT guy. So, you know, these are good questions. Why should I answer these questions, right? So, now, going back to X space. Oh no. Okay. So, more explicitly, what is written there, right? Explicitly. So K, this vector K, has K0, time component of K, and the vector component of K. So X will be time and the vector of X. Now I'm in Lorentzian signature, so K square equals to minus K0 square plus K vector square. And it's also useful to define this guy here, frequency for given k. And then what you have is that t of x equals to this formula here, d4 of k, 2 pi to the 4, e to I k times x. And then instead of k square, so I write k square here as this guy and that guy. But for that guy, I use this omega thing. Where is k square? Here? K square, sure. Thank you. That would make sense, right? If you have vector plus scalar. Something very weird. So k0 square minus omega k square and then plus I epsilon. Okay. So that's what you have derived that d of x is. Very good. So now you can integrate this. Over, so it is useful. So this is your result. So for QFT applications, usually this is enough. So now you can write this. But another useful formula is that you actually integrate over K0. And this you will do in your tutorial. Over K0. So if you do that, you'll find out that t of x equals to, and I don't have long enough blackboard. So imagine how difficult your tutorial will be. Okay, so it's minus I d3 of k, so only integration over spatial part remains, 2 pi cube. Now this omega k comes down, and you have two terms, e to minus I omega kt minus k, now spatial k times spatial x. And this is for t bigger than 0. And then you have another term for t smaller than 0, and it's a similar term, plus kx. Kx, and this is for OK, so that is the result if you integrate over k0. And you see that when you integrate over k0, you will have to really distinguish two cases. T is bigger than 0, and t is smaller than 0. So your integration will split into two parts. That's a very good hint. So now I am saying, so this is the behavior of the field. OK, and it has an interpretation. This is an amplitude. Amplitude for a disturbance in the field. To propagate. Now, because I set basically y equal to 0, I start at the origin. So to propagate from the origin to some space-time point x. OK, so to propagate from the origin, otherwise it will be from x to y. From the origin to x. OK. And it happens that actually, so it happens is that the behavior is different if you are inside the light cone or if you are outside of the light cone. So you know from special relativity that if something is in the origin, if the particle is in the origin, it can only go inside the light cone. It can never jump outside of light cone because it would have to travel with the speed which is higher than the speed of light, right? So the normal particle have to always stay inside light cone. Can travel like that, but never can travel like that. OK. So if you look at this thing here, and again, part of your tutorial, then in the light cone, you get nice waves. Actually, this behaves like nice waves, and everything is fine. However, if you look at the propagators of propagating from here to x, which is outside of the light cone, it's still non-trivial. But it goes like e to minus m of spatial distance x. So actually, the quantum field can leak outside of the light cone. It can travel faster than light. But this is exponentially suppressed. So it cannot travel very far from the light cone. But it can travel outside of light cone. So the statement is that classically, a particle cannot travel faster than light, so cannot get outside the light cone. Light cone, but quantum field can leak out. And then the distance is, so you know, this exponential would be very, very tiny if the distance is bigger than 1 over m. So can leak out over a distance, let's say 1 over m, but you know, then it's already suppressed by 3, and then if you go 1 over whatever 2m, then it's suppressed by e square and so on. So that's, you know, so this will, you will instigate this in today's tutorial. Questions, comments?
Causality is not violated, right?
Huh?
Causality is still good.
OK, so there are tricks. Again, ask your QFT guy. I don't have time to discuss this. But basically, this is resolved by the fact that there are antiparticles as well. So you have also like negative modes. And then, you know, everything is fine. You don't travel backwards in time, stuff like that. But you have also, you know, various particles. You have antiparticles and so on. This resolved by that. Okay. So that was application one.
What about if you send the mass to zero?
If you send mass to zero. Okay. And 1/0 is infinity. Okay. Well, if you have massive particles, they travel at the speed of light most of the time. But the problem is that you may have also virtual particles. So in quantum field theory, you know, photon not always have mass equal to zero. You can create photons which are off-shell, so-called off-shell, which don't have mass equal to zero. So yeah, so there are these things. Okay, second application. Degrees of freedom. Okay. And let's do it in D dimensions so that you are ready for your string theory course. Because string theory needs 10, 26 dimensions, so D dimensions. And this is basically how to calculate properly that photon has two polarizations, right? So I showed you that you have E's and B's, in total six quantities. You can trade them for A and phi, four quantities. These are not all independent, blah, blah, blah. But in fact, all boils down that the photon has 2 degrees of freedom. So how to guess that the photon has 2 degrees of freedom? Okay. But let me start this even simple case, so with the scalar field. Scalar field. We already studied that, so we have this equation e squared minus m squared on phi equals to zero. So now this is a course on Fourier transform, so let's do Fourier transform. So Fourier transform, write phi of x to be, again, this thing. So now we are in d dimension, so dd p 2 pi to d phi of p Fourier image and e to I p times x. Okay, you write that. So now, what does it mean is that if I plug this guy here like that, and from here I know that p square plus m square acting on phi of p equals to zero. So that's the equation which I get in the Fourier space, which I have done just now, and you can do it again if you want. Okay, so that's my equation in the p space. And now I have two possibilities, right? So I need to solve this equation. So I have two possibilities. So first possibility is that p square plus m square is not equal to zero. Okay, if that is true, what is the solution? Exactly. So from here, I have phi p equals to zero. So my scale field must be not necessarily trivial. Of course, what it means is that I have 0 degrees of freedom. There's no scale field. There's no physics, right? Or the other possibility is that it is equal to zero. So p square plus m square equals to zero. So this is nothing else than actually the relativistic energy equation. So if I write p to be e and p vector, then p square is minus e square plus p square. So this is minus e square plus p vector square plus m square equals to zero. And in other words, e square is p square plus m square, and it's a relativistic conservation of energy, or I don't know, a relativistic equation for energy. And in quantum field theory, this is called mass shell condition. So if p squared plus m squared equals to 0, that's your particle is so-called on mass shell, and then it satisfies what it's supposed to satisfy. So if that is true, I may have solution for phi, right? If p squared plus m squared equals to 0, then phi is basically anything. So then phi p exists. And now how you count degrees of freedom? So basically, for any p, I get one function, phi, which satisfies, so you are in spacetime. So for each p or for each x, you can find one scalar function which describes your field. So there is, then you would say there's one degree of freedom per spacetime point. Okay, so scalar field has one degree of freedom. Okay, so that was simple. So now we go to gauge theory, so to electromagnetism, or to gravity. Any questions to this? Yeah?
Yeah, so the meaning of degrees of freedom, I mean, in your P vector, you have all these components that you're free to choose to set.
No, it's really, so what do you mean by here by degrees of freedom? How many functions I need per space-time point to describe my physics? So here you have one scalar function, you say, that is 1 degree of freedom. If you have complex field, then you will find that, well, phi is a complex, so it has actually two numbers. It's real part and imaginary part. Then you would say complex field. Complex scale field has 2 degrees of freedom. So B, interesting part now, gauge field. Okay, so today's lecture is special. It's all these bonus questions and all these complicated things. So, but I want you to remember one thing from this lecture, and that's the following rule I will write down. So that's the most important part of this lecture. And you know, once you remember this rule, your life will be very easy in future. So there's a rule which I'll prove in special case. But so in any gauge theory, number of degrees of freedom. The real number of degrees of freedom equals to the number of apparent degrees of freedom minus twice degrees of freedom of the gauge function. The golden rule of gauge theories. Okay, so what does it mean? So that's the rule. Let me apply it to electromagnetism. So the electromagnetism is a gauge theory. So in electromagnetism, you know that you describe your electromagnetic field by A mu. Phi and A. So it means that per space-time point, I need 1 plus 3 numbers to describe my field. So number of apparent degrees of freedom here will be 4. Okay. So now you know that there is this function lambda. This function lambda is a gauge function, which is an arbitrary function. And that is a scalar function. It's just one function of x. So it's a scalar, so it has one number. And that's the degree of freedom of the gauge function. So it's 4 minus 2 times 1, and you get 2, which are indeed 2 polarizations of the photon. So 2 polarizations of the photon. Okay, so it's only, so a circular polarization left, circular polarization right, or it goes like that, but it's always only 2 independent polarizations of the photon. So this will work for any gauge theory. So remember this rule, it's a very nice rule. Okay. So now let me prove that.
David,
yeah.
How do you get that it's 2 times?
It's in the rule. It's 2 times. So basically, you can say what does it mean is that each gauge function you can actually use twice to kill degrees of freedom. You will see it explicitly now. Yeah, so each gauge function you can use twice. Okay. So one more concept I need to tell you, but it's not that terrible. So-called light cone coordinates. That's something very, very useful, which you'll encounter in quantum field theory, in string theory. Basically, they are good coordinates to extract real degrees of freedom. Okay, so what does it mean that I write vector A? So far I was writing vector, four-dimensional vector, let's say, as A0, A1, A2, A3, blah, blah, blah. So now you don't write it like that, but you write A plus, A minus, that's 0, 1, and A2, A3, and so on. A3, A4, up to blah, 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 and you call these AI, the index I goes from 2 to higher things. So, okay, so now relation to your what you are familiar with, so you have A0, it's a combination of A plus and A minus.
Okay. Where does the index I go to?
So I runs from 2 to, if you are in D, so it's
we're
D minus 1. Yeah, if you are in D dimensions, it goes to D minus 1. Okay, so now A0, your famous A0, T, for example, and if you have X vector, it's just a linear combination of plus and minus. So it is 1 over square root of 2 A plus A minus, and A1 is the other combination of that. So it's A plus minus A minus. Okay, that's the relation to your familiar A0 and A1. It's just a combination, so you just, you know, combine these things. Okay. So now, once you have this, then the scalar product of function, so it was before, it was minus A0 square plus A1 square plus AI, sum over I, right? A2, A3. So now if you write it in terms of, just try to write it in terms of plus and minus, you'll find out that this is now minus A minus A plus minus A, sorry. That was too simple. So A1, B1, sorry for that, BI. Now it's better. Okay, sorry for that. So this is A minus, B plus, A plus, B minus, and then AI, BI. I haven't done anything to the other ones. Okay, so that's how you take a scalar product now. It's just, you know, simplifying, defining new coordinates, you know, coordinate transformation, and then your scale product turns out to be slightly something different. So what does it mean? That your metric tensor, if you want, is not minus 1 plus plus plus, but rather it is 0, minus 1, minus 1, 0, and then there's this 1 here, 0 here, there's 0 there. That's what it means. Okay, so the last concept needed to prove something. So let's now use this. Okay. So who is not happy about A plus and A minus? Somebody who is not happy? Everybody's happy. Okay. So C, let's do Maxwell. I lost B, right? Doesn't matter. Okay. So now you know that you have this electromagnetic potential A mu, and it satisfies the equations which I have derived in yesterday. So we have D square A mu. So now we are in vacuum. So let's do it. So this is in vacuum. So J equals to 0, rho equals to 0. So D square on A mu, that was box on A mu equals to 4 pi J mu. Now 4 pi j mu is 0, but I used my Lorentz condition, right, in order to get a wave equation. So now let's not use it so far. Let's keep it general at this point. And my Lorentz condition was that d mu a mu equals to 0, which I write as d times a equals to 0. So this is my Lorentz condition. So I can set it equal to 0, but let's not do it at this point. Let's not fix the gauge. Okay, so this is your Maxwell equation, and then you have, so this is, and you have gauge freedom, to change your potential by a derivative of lambda function. Right, so we notice that we can change phi by dt of lambda, and we can change a by nabla of lambda, which is precisely this thing here. Okay, and this is my gauge function. Okay, so there's nothing really fancy about this. So now again, we do the Fourier transform. So we write this to be dp 2 pi d in d dimensions now, a mu of p e to I p times x. Okay, I'm writing the Fourier transform here. And then I apply my operator on this thing. So what does it mean that for each derivative, I bring down IP, right? For each derivative, I bring down IP. So I have IP square, which is minus. So it's minus P square A mu of P. Then minus IP minus IP. So now there is a scale product, so it's p mu x mu. So that's why if I see an index, I have to write an index. So I have I p mu there. And then I have p times a equals to 0. Interesting. Very good. Not really. There's also IP here, right? There's also, so there's derivative there, so there's also IP, so it's actually I is gone, and it becomes plus. Sorry for that. Yeah. Okay. So now it's correct. Okay. I can also Fourier transform this condition here. So I have delta A mu equals to now I P mu and lambda. So I Fourier transform all these things. So these are my equations in the P space. And now all I have to do is actually I have to plug in what these equations mean for all the values of mu. Mu equals to plus, minus, and I. Okay. So now you can always arrange your, so if P is non-trivial, you can, if it's a non-trivial vector, it has one non-trivial component. Let's arrange my coordinate so that this non-trivial component is plus. So I'll always assume, and which you can, I think almost every time you can do it. So without loss of generality, you can assume that P plus is non-trivial. I simply, if I have non-trivial P, then I must have non-trivial component. Let's call it P plus. Okay. So then what does this condition tell me? It tells me that delta of A plus equals to I P plus times lambda. Okay. So if I start with some A and do my gauge transformation, I can change my A plus of that A by an arbitrary function, because this is an arbitrary thing. So if I started with A plus, let's say 1, I can always find such lambda that A plus now will be 0. Right? I can always tune, so choose lambda so that A plus of my new vector is 0. So I killed 1 degree of freedom. Okay. So this is what you would naively expect that you can do with your function, right? That you can kill 1 degree of freedom by choosing the value of lambda. Okay, so that was the first step. So now let's look at this equation at mu equal to plus. Okay, so we have minus p square a plus plus p plus p times a equals to 0. Okay, but now I arrange that a plus equals to 0, right? And also, without loss of generality, I know that p plus is not equal to 0. So this is 0. This is non-zero. So this guy must be 0, right? So from here, I know that this guy, p times a, must be equal to 0. But what is p times a? So p times a, using that stupid product rule which I just deleted, was minus p plus a minus minus p minus a plus plus pi ai. Right? This is how my scale product is defined. So a plus is 0. That's fine. So p plus is non-trivial, so I can divide by p plus. Right? So from here, I conclude that a minus equals to pi ai over p plus. So what does it mean? I have already deleted a plus, right? But now I'm saying a minus is not independent. A minus actually depends on ai. So once I know ai, I know a minus as well. So I killed another degree of freedom. Okay? So you killed 2 degrees of freedom. Now you can look at this equation here again. So So now we know that P times A is zero, right? So all what is left from that equation, which I still haven't written down, is that P square. So I am left with, an equation P square on A of I equals to zero. That's all what is left. So I've set A plus equal to zero. Once I know AI, I know what A minus is. And the remaining equation for AI is this equation here. That's all the content of Maxwell theory, right? Very good. So now again, I have two possibilities. P square is not equal to zero. If P square is not equal to zero, then all AIs must be equal to zero. But if all AIs are equal to zero, then A minus is equal to zero, and A plus is equal to zero. So then A mu is equal to zero, and you have 0 degrees of freedom. So if you are not on shell, you have 0 degrees of freedom. On the other hand, if P square is equal to zero, then AI are arbitrary. So how many are there? There are d minus 2 of them. So you have d minus 2 degrees of freedom. OK, so in particular, if you have 4 dimensions, your Maxwell field will have 2 degrees of freedom. OK, questions? Yeah?
Might be sort of stupid, but I assume mu and u is the same whether I use these funny coordinates or not.
That's right. Well, the value will be the same. It's a scalar which has the same value in any coordinate system. Okay. That's right. But you can write it in different forms, right? Depending on how I define my metric tensor, I will have different expressions in different coordinates for this. But the value is the same. Yes.
There's an advantage in using the cone-like coordinates, because eventually what you did there is to choose a gauge, and from your gauge you count how many degrees of freedom you have left.
That's right. Well, if I didn't, well, look at that beauty. Why I'm doing all this is that if you write scale product like this, you always have so one of the good things is, for example, if I consider A times A, then you would have A plus A minus. So you could solve for A minus, let's say, right? And it's a linear expression for A minus. If you have normal field product, you have a quadratic expression. You have A0 square, A1 square. You get two solutions. You get plus minus square root of something. So this is one advantage why you are using these things.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the other thing, going to Fourier space, it's the best way to count those sort of degrees of freedom?
I think it is, yeah. You can start arguing these differential equations. You can do that. You can read that in various books. But I think this is the cleanest way, Fourier transform, assume P plus non equal to zero, and then you see how actually your equations deconstruct themselves to something very, very trivial. Right? So I think it's the most beautiful way how to see this.
If you had like an extra gauge function, you couldn't make the same argument, could you? Like with the P plus and P minus.
If you had extra gauge.
Like you have a lambda 2.
Okay, you will see that in tutorial today. Okay, so maybe two final remarks. So I will have no time to tell you what I'm doing. So that's fine. So if you are interested, we can talk about it later. Okay, so remark, so first that if p square is not equal to zero, if p square is not equal to zero, then looking at this equation, I can divide by p square, right? If I'm not dividing by zero, I can divide by p square. So I can immediately write down solution for a mu, right? So I can write down that a mu p equals to 1 over p square p mu p times a. Question, is this nice solution of Maxwell equations? What do you think? Very good. So thank you for both answers. They complete. It's a complete answer now. So of course, p square is not equal to zero. So I have 0 degrees of freedom, right? So it means that this guy must be a pure gauge. That's what you said, and that is what you said. So very good. So it means that I can choose lambda to be minus I p times a over p square. It will kill that field, so eliminate this. So I have pure gauge. There's no real electromagnetic field here. So that's first remark. Second remark is that you can write down one photon state as, so now you know that the only non-trivial things are AIs. A plus is 0, A minus is determined by AI. So you go from 2 to D minus 1 to 1. OK. In my case, it was 2 to D minus 1. Yeah. 2 to D minus 1. So now you can put arbitrary polarizations. And then you create operators with P plus and PI. I and dagger on your vacuum. So this is a creation operator on the vacuum. You create a state with P plus and PI with the momenta like that. And you can create I independent number of them depending on the polarizations of the photon you can create. So one photon state in general will be a linear combination of these things. And these are the constants of expansion. So that's a one photon state. Okay, so you have D minus 2 polarizations you can create.